This special episode is an Ecosocialism 101 workshop. This workshop is part of the Green Socialist Organizing Project's 101 series. To learn more about the series, visit greensocialist.net/101s.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us for this month's 101 workshop. This month, we are continuing our trek to close out the year with our original three workshops, refined and updated. So last month, we did Green Party 101. This month is Eco-Socialism 101. And next month, we'll close out the year with Organizing 101. But again, thank you for joining us. We've been doing these monthly 101 workshops going on 2 years now. It's part of our education project with the Green Socialist Organizing Project. My name is Chris Blankenhorn. I am presently the Illinois Green Party secretary, a former GPUS co-chair, and served as the social media and tech director for Hawkins Walker 2020. Joining me is Garrett Wasserman. I'll let him introduce himself.
Hi, everyone. Garrett Wasserman, and similar to Chris, I'm a former Green Party United States steering committee co-chair. I've been active with the Green Party at all levels, local, state, and national. In my state of Pennsylvania, I've worked on ballot access. I've worked on the platform of the Green Party, educational work, all that sort of stuff. So I'm glad to be here for the 101.
Yep. And again, yep. Today we're going to talk about Eco-Socialism 101. We started this 101 series in 2022, and we had three workshops were the Green Socialist Organizing Project. So it's not surprising that those workshops were Green Party 101, Eco-Socialism 101, and Organizing 101. In 2023, we veered off. We still have done these ones, but we added a lot of kind of diving deeper into some of the issues we talked about across the main three. This year, we have talked about decentralization. We've talked about independent politics. We've talked about workers' rights. We've talked about the eco-socialist Green New Deal. And then, as I said, we're closing out the year for 2023 with our original three. but we've taken them and we've refined them. We've changed it up. We've tried to learn from our last 2 years of doing them. And so this is our, last Eco-Socialism 101 of 2023. if you want to learn more about this project in our 101 series, you can go to greensocialist.net/101s. You can see past sessions. You can see access the slideshows. You can listen to it on podcast platforms if that's your preferred medium for this kind of podcast stuff or workshop stuff. But with that, obviously Eco-Socialism 101 is a rather large topic that we're going to try to cover in an hour. So with that, we will get started and get rolling. Eco-Socialism 101, an introduction to ecological socialism and green political thought. An outline of today's presentation, we're going to talk about what is socialism, Marxism and other socialist views on capitalism, outline of historical socialist thought and debate. So we're going to give you, kind of this history, socialist movements and history, and then lay that foundation for where green socialist thought and where eco-socialist thought came from. And then we're going to get into, what the formation of modern eco-socialism and where do we go next. So the goal of this workshop is to develop a shared eco-socialist terminology and a historical context that we can use to have deeper conversations. But we think it's important that we get, that background, that historical context. And it's really important, I think, as Greens and as leftists, that we develop a common language, right? A common historical understanding. Because often we have these debates and what we learn is we don't actually believe the same fundamental things, right? We have some glaring differences and that leads to conflict where we're kind of engaging with the conflict at the top level, but it's really a foundational level.
Yeah. So we come from different backgrounds, and especially if you've done any reading on socialism, there's different entry points. So everyone kind of comes with a different background, and then we start talking past each other. So it's nice to be able to have terminology where we can kind of clearly grapple with the real issues.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Murray Bookchin later, but Murray Bookchin was a big influence on the Green Party and the left flank of the Green Party, and was a big advocate for developing a common understanding and developing a common foundation. So that's kind of that idea was kind of the impetus for these 101s. So to start off, what is socialism? Socialism is a theory of society in which workers own the means of social production, the social means of production. In which it's a theory of society in which the workers will use them, the means of production, not to produce for the millionaires, but to fill the land with wealth so that poverty, such as we may now understand it, is abolished. And that's a very butchered version of a Eugene Debs quote. About halfway through, I remembered I was reading a quote and not riffing, right? But what is socialism? The core answer is worker and social ownership of production, right? And the goal of socialism is to abolish poverty. That's why we are socialists, right? So this leads to two questions, which are linked. Can socialism actually work? And can capitalism really be abolished? So can socialism actually work? Yes. History shows that humans have mostly lived in some type of egalitarian and socialist society. Peter Kropotkin, in his book Mutual Aid, A Factor in Evolution, talked about how mutualism and cooperation is more normal than competition. Often you'll hear, especially people that lean right, talk about that, the idea that human nature is to compete, but the reality is human nature, human survival, human success has all been built around cooperation. Obviously there has long been power struggles. There have long been hierarchies and power imbalances since even before, capitalism rose a few hundred years ago. But when you look at the scope of human history, what you see is that collaboration and cooperation and mutualism is actually, one of the driving forces of human success and human survival. Eleanor Ostrom in Governing the Commons talked about how social ownership and government of the commons is common throughout all cultures and all history, and that social ownership is very successful. The commons, as we know them, the public sphere, the things that are owned by all of us, was generally forcibly privatized with capitalism. And we're seeing that even more with neoliberalism, which we'll get into later. But one of the key pillars of neoliberalism is privatization, right? The little bit of the commons that we still have is being worn away under the neoliberal systems that we have now that rule the world. And it's important to note, right? And this is a big, kind of a big part of selling socialism. Socialism isn't an end goal, but it's an ongoing process, right? This isn't something where there's peace, love, and happiness when we check all the boxes. As long as there are people on Earth, as long as there are two of us, we're going to have disagreements. We live on a dynamic Earth and a dynamic ecosystem. So that means we're going to have to adapt, right? So there is no just kind of peaceful end state. And I'm very Marxist in that sense, that I don't believe in a peaceful end state where just everything's sunshine and rainbows, right? We're always going to have to keep evolving. We're always going to have to keep adjusting. We're always going to have to maintain a fluidity because society and nature are not static, right? They are fluid things. And so when we're organizing and we're pushing, we're working within within a dynamic system. So we will always have to remain dynamic. That said, we can learn from history and we can form new strategies, right? It's really important. A lot of socialists really get, anchored down to deifying past theory and deifying past projects. And we can absolutely learn from those things, but we're, again, we live in a dynamic world. And so those things that were true then may not be true now. The things that worked then may not work now. The things that failed then may work now. Right. And so we can learn those lessons, but we've got to be applying them to our current material conditions. And it's always going to be an ongoing process. Yeah. So it's hard as a socialist organizer, because often people will want a vision of that end point. Right. And there isn't one. There really isn't one. And it's a setup for failure when you get asked that. So you should recognize it, because people will often ask it. You can try to flip it on them. What's the end point for capitalism? The world burning down, right? It's what we're heading towards at 90, at 60 miles an hour, straight off the edge of the cliff. So, I think it's really important that we understand that socialism isn't an end goal, but it's a process, and that we learn from history to form these new strategies, which leads to the question, can we abolish capitalism? Ursula Le Guin said, "We live in capitalism. Its power, it seems, escapable. But then so did the divine right of kings. Any power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words." And I think that, that bolded point is really, really important, right? Capitalism in our modern society is often treated as a natural thing, right? Something that is grown from the earth, when then the reality is it was imposed violently by man. And that's, I'll choose non-gendered terms, but by man, right? In this case, it was overwhelmingly by white men. So, it's just something to keep in mind there, but, we have to always remember, right? When things seem unbeatable, when things seem too big, when we don't feel like we can get over the hump, the reality is we have to remember this is a human created system. Human created systems can be torn down and new systems can be built and replaced them, just as capitalism did, in its birth. Another important point is our critique of capitalism must be leftist. The left has no monopoly on critiques of capitalism. And given its present historical weaknesses, there is a great danger at the rise of reactionary forms of anti-capitalism. That's from Blair Taylor, who we'll talk a little bit about later too. But we must develop an eco-socialist analysis and response to capitalism. If there's no, and I think this last sentence is really important to think about in the United States right now. If there is no leftist vision to counter it, reactionary politics will look to blame others, right? So when I think about some of the organizing calls we've done and things like that, people say, I live in a really red rural area. How do I organize? Those places have been abandoned by everyone but the right wing, right? Even the Democrats, who are a right center right party, they don't play there, right? The entirety of rural America has been abandoned to reactionary politics, and as such, it should not be surprising that reactionary politics have taken hold, right? So if we want a leftist future, we have to have a leftist analysis. And when we think about something like climate change, this is incredibly important, because again, we're accelerating off a cliff, we're headed off that cliff, and we have options, right? We can take an eco-socialist path. We can pull things back. We can create a world and a society that is made for all of us and not just the few. But the other side of this is eco-fascism, right? The climate crisis is not alone, not the sole domain of the left. And especially given the weakness of the left, the solutions certainly aren't. And so we've really got, we really have to push, because if in the absence of a left voice, in the absence of a left power, the right will take control and the right will be in control. And we will end up, in the case of the climate, with climate change being just used to justify a further growth and expansion of fascism. So some quick terminology, before we get started. You've heard me talk about, the Democrats are center right. This is where we're going to talk about that. But we often talk about things in left and right, and in the United States and in many other countries, that's very skewed, right? If you listen to a Republican, you would think Joe Biden's a communist. Joe Biden is a far right wing capitalist, right? Our political narrative and our political language in this country has shifted so far right that what is considered the left in this country is solidly left, or solidly right of center, right? The best you can see it, you can expect out of, the main quote unquote left, wing of U.S. politics and the Democratic Party are centrists. Right. You know, even Bernie Sanders and AOC and the Squad are, when you look at their politics, are slightly left of center, but they aren't anti-capitalist. They aren't, crossing that line into the left. So when we think about this, right, we've got on the left, we've got progressivism. Markets are inherently unfair to many. So we need some amount of social safety nets and regulation. Socialism gets into social ownership of the economy. Left libertarianism is, socialism without the centralized state. And then anarchism is kind of interchangeable in there, but it doesn't just stop at the state and with capital. It opposes all hierarchies. So it's a little more, anti-authoritarian than left libertarianism would traditionally be thought of. And then on the right, we've got liberalism, markets and individualism, our freedom. Markets need some regulations to work, but capitalism is the main goal. It's the driving factor. Neoliberalism is what we have in a lot of our Western states today. It's reducing a lot of those regulations, and it's a major focus on privatizing what's left of the commons. You've got right libertarianism, which is mainly focused in the United States in terms of calling it libertarianism, but it's minimal government in favor of an unregulated free market and extreme individualism and privatization. And then you've got neoconservatism and getting into fascism with peace through strength, foreign interventions to maintain strength. And when you look at that, you can see a lot of that whole right spectrum in both of our major parties, because we have two right-wing parties in the United States. Especially that last one, peace through strength and foreign intervention, right? The Democrats are just as hard on that as Republicans are, and sometimes when they're in power, even more so. So when we, when we talk about the center, what we're talking about is progressivism and liberalism, right? That's kind of the center. If we were to take these and take them out of their two columns and put them into a row, your center would be progressivism on the center left and liberalism on the center right, with everything else, falling further down the spectrum. The socialist tendencies would be socialism, left libertarianism, and anarchism. And then obviously the right wing, the right wing stuff follows that kind of same path. A couple more pieces of terminology. Class is a grouping of people into hierarchical social categories, often for economic reasons, wealth, income, occupation, education. In the US, we often talked about this upper, middle, and lower or working class. Socialists usually split this into two big categories, the owning or employing class, which is the bourgeoisie, and the working class, which is the proletariat. So a traditional socialist analysis of class would break it down less than we do in common U.S. terminology and conversation. And then the state, nation states, largely synonymous with the government, and there are plenty of alternatives. The nation state system rose, alongside capitalism. It was out there, and it and capitalism really merged to grow together. Some alternatives include to states include federations of communities via free association. So that's, kind of the basic level without getting into talking about what most people think of when they think of socialism, right? Getting into those theories and those thoughts. A classical Marxist analysis of capitalism, and we call these bullet points oversimplified key elements of Marxist analysis of capitalism. The stack of, works that Marx and Engels alone produced very much would not be coverable, right, in an hour-long presentation, let alone a section of an hour-long presentation. In college I took whole classes just on Marxism, and so to talk about this in one slide, we're obviously very much oversimplifying, but some basics of classical Marxist analysis is class struggle is the primary driver of human history as the owning ruling class privatizes what was once the public commons for profit and oppresses the working class who must struggle for greater freedom. So Marxists very much think that class struggle is the core main driving thing behind change in human history. The state, which is the modern republican government, arose from monarchy and feudalism and was perfected under capitalism to indirectly manage society and affairs on behalf of the owning class via wealth and influence, right? And so as capitalism rose and, helped form what we know as the modern state, the modern government, it did so in a way that allowed the capitalists to maintain control without being in control visibly, right? It gave them a mechanism by which to play puppeteer rather than just openly, rather than just openly having corporate control. The state enforces material relative scarcity, poverty, via mechanisms like laws and policing for the benefits of the ruling class, right? Most conversations about the history of policing will point out, right, that the first, official police departments were about slavery, were about slave catching. And so it's always, the state is the violent actor. It's how capitalism is enforced. Capitalism will always be compelled to grow more and more wealth for the ruling class by stealing more and more from the working class. This obviously isn't sustainable on a finite planet. So capitalism is doomed to eventually collapse. And we can see, we're on the train as it heads off the cliff. We can see this happening right now. The proletariat or the working class can and must gain power to accelerate the end of capitalism and its own oppression, replacing it with a workers' state. I think maybe probably more so than in Marx's time, that's an important point. In generations past, we may have been able to slow roll change. Right, we may have been able to have a gradual transition, but we're at the point of multimodal crises, whether it be the climate or economics or, the impending doom of nuclear warfare and things like that, that we don't have time to slow roll, right? It really is essential that the working class gain power, and shift things right now, because the capitalist class is not going to shift. It's not going to make the shifts we need to survive as modern global society. And then the worker state that, once the workers take control under classical Marxism, the worker state is predicted to wither away into a classless communist society as relative scarcity is overcome. And we'll get into, that's a big point of conflict on the left, right? That is one of the major points of conflict across the left. A little bit about the concept of class struggle from the preamble of the International Workers of the World. The working class and the employee class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things in life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of a new society within the shell of the old. And again, that's the IWW, so that's a bottom left, labor organization. That's the perspective from bottom up worker centric focus. And I think it's important to note, right, this is coming out of labor, but right there, live in harmony with the earth. And when you look at liberal labor movements, right, when you look at someone like the AFL-CIO, who long has supported pipeline projects and has police unions as members, right, this is a radical, the IWW is a radical shift from that. And the idea that the left was slow to get on board with ecology historically, we'll talk about that a little too, but the IWW has kind of always been there on it. They've always kind of understood that we have to live in within the balance of the earth. So some characteristics of modern capitalism. What is capitalism? In What Is Capitalism, Peter Stottermeyer identified four unique characteristics of capitalism. Commodity production in exchange for profit. Outsized roles of market in society and market relationships. property is private investment, and exploited labor with no say in production or administration. So those are 4 points that Peter Stottlemyre identified that differentiates, you know, modern capitalism, what we're seeing today. Obviously, those of they're all core points of capitalism, but that's really the heads that are rising right now. Eric Larson in the Operating System of Modern Theory of the State talked about, you know, that combination of the state and capital that we've mentioned a few times. The state is a political, socio-cultural, and economic entity conceived and established by humans that controls the functions and relations in society, the economy, and with nature. The state, and this one's really important, the state claims monopoly, a monopoly on determining personhood and the use of force and violence, right? And to put that in context of, you know, our current, current event conflicts, when you look at, you know, what's happening in Gaza, the defense of the state of Israel is it has a right to do that. But the social, you know, the society, the people of Gaza, under the state, you know, the modern theory of the state, they do not have the right to rebel. And we see this playing out in our narratives, right? When we see how governments talk about, you know, Western governments talk about this conflict, we see this idea that the state claims monopoly, and it's essential for them to maintain that monopoly, right? Because if they don't, then they give us the power to rebel. And they really don't want that. They need that monopoly on the use of force and violence, and that monopoly on the legitimization of a people. And then the state is totalizing. It's hierarchical, technocratic. It fetishizes patriarchal leadership. It adopts a sense of density, destiny. It absorbs and regulates. It extracts value from all social activities and enforces uniformity to squeeze out maximum profit. Right. So, there are still, like, my mentor Richard Gilman Opalski wrote his most recent book is about the communism of love. That's what it's called. And one of the things he talks about, right, is that love and these interpersonal relationships are some of the few bastions where it hasn't been commodified, but it has, right? They're trying really, really, really hard. And so, you know, while we may still have those little glimpses, that's really the only place. Almost everywhere else in our lives, almost everything else that we do is interconnected with the state and capitalism, right? Because the state and capitalism are both, you know, they're both totalitarian, right? They're both total in their control. Which is, you know, how do they do that? That comes down to cultural hegemony, which we get from Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was a leftist operating in the early 1900s. He was a very early critic of the Soviet Union from the left, saying that they were not in fact a socialist society, that they were a state capitalist society. And this, you know, this critique was coming alongside their founding, right? So it's not a new thing. But capitalism is not just an economic system. It's now a whole type of society and culture, and it dominates politics. And Adorno and Horkheimer, another couple of writers that write about this in the culture industry, right? One of my favorite, it's important to understand Marxism is not one person's work. It started and ended there. Right. Marxism is a methodology that's been adopted, and it's like socialism is a process, and it's grown and it's evolved over time. And so one of my favorite aspects of this growth were, you know, Marx building on Hegel and Feuerbach and, you know, other thinkers before him, put out his foundational works. But it didn't stop there, right? We just talked about Gramsci and cultural hegemony. When Marx was forming his ideas, and you even saw Marx's ideas change over time as the world around him changed, because he really was there in a pivotal point of the growth of capitalism. But at his time, there were different German states, right? The England and Italy had distinct cultures, the totality of capitalism and the state merging wasn't real yet. Gramsci really started to identify that, right? In the 1920s, capitalism had such great control and domination over culture that it's convinced many of the working class that it's natural, like we said, and the normal order of things, rather than seeing it as a recent development in human history, right? So Marx couldn't see that merger, He couldn't see that capitalism and the state unifying into that totality. Gramsci started to see that, right? And then you get into the the post-war period with Adorno and Horkheimer, and they're writing about the culture industry, and now capitalism is creating culture, and it's a reifying system. And then, you know, you get Guy Debord coming in after that and talking about, you know, the society of the spectacle and the myth and the bauble with it in which, you know, we've lived that leads us to believe that capitalism is natural and normal. And then it explodes, right? Then we've got like Angela Davis adding, you know, racial justice in, and we've got, you know, Julia Kristeva adding in psychoanalysis, and it just boom, 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 because it's not something that ended when Marx passed, right? Or when not even Marx passed. Sorry. Marx passing didn't even stop the works with Marx's name, right? He died before he finished Capital, and Engels finished it. But we really saw this explosion. And so that's really important. And socialists need to first teach history and socialist analysis to the public. We need to develop a working class culture that's critical of capitalism before systematic change can happen. And when we look at our culture, we can see that how needed that is. Unfortunately, the left in the United States and the West has largely failed at that. Blair Taylor has a piece called Seven Myths About Capitalism that explores common misconceptions about capitalism by progressives and leftists. These false explanations lead to misplaced criticism and ineffective organizing. As someone who started, you know, their full speed political organizing in Occupy, in the Occupy movement, oh, this list, man. It takes me back, you know, 2011 and 2012 and the fights that I had within the movement because of things like greed caused this, right? What is greed? Greed is, you know, taking self-preservation and self-interest to a radical level, right? And we all have self-interest. It's just part of what we have. Corruption caused this, right? This isn't the problem of capital. It's the problem of corrupt people, which stops us from looking at systems and instead gets us looking at individuals. Wall Street and monetary policy caused this, right? Big corporations caused this. But capitalism existed before those things. Those are certainly tools of capitalism. Those are certainly some of the key tools in their bag right now. But they are not the end all be all. And ending them would not guarantee an end to capitalism. Conspiracy caused this is a really dangerous one, right? Because when you look at the world around us, no one's happy. Left or right, no one thinks things are going right. And so the idea that we live in a failed state, that capitalism is failing, really isn't controversial. Now, using that term might have people push back, but when you start talking to people, you find out most people don't think that what we have, right, our society is succeeding. And so they take that first step of questioning. But because we don't have a serious left in this country, they get sucked in, right? They're now susceptible. Their worldview has been shattered. The bauble's been broken, and they're looking for something new. And too often, especially in the West, they can fall into these conspiracy holes. The idea of argument, and we see this in the Trump MAGA movement, the idea that taking America back and returning to normal is what we need, but that doesn't recognize that the United States has always been like this, right? The core things about the United States are the problem. I know a lot of people that really deify the Constitution, but when you read past the pretty words of the Constitution, what you find out is that it's a document that established a country that was an oligarchy, that established a country that was built on racism, sexism, classism, right? That was built on the theft of land. And so when we deify the past and we, when we have this rose-colored vision of the past, it completely distorts what the real problem is, because the problem was there then too, right? The times that people often say were nice and were the boom times and the great times were not great for everyone. They just happened to be on the top of the hill, or not even on the top. They happened to be on the hill and sort of under the hill at that point. And then the idea that we can build full alternatives to capitalism now without addressing how difficult it is to build autonomy under the totality of capitalism, right? A lot of people talk about, you know, creating our own parallel system that will somehow, you know, win the dialectical battle. But with the totality of capitalism today, it's a huge task, right? We really have to understand that we can't just carve out this niche and exist in socialism there. You know, it's one of the it's one of the downfalls of the co-op movement, for example, right? Yes, a worker-owned business is better than a privately owned business in terms of the rights of the workers. But if it's still operating within the global capitalist system, it's not really you know, the co-op movement is not threatening capitalism. Small worker-owned projects under capitalism are not threatening capitalism. So we have to understand that the totality of capitalism requires that the totality of capitalism be addressed. I will turn it over to Garrett. I actually covered that first half in like 30 minutes after the intro. I'm pretty impressed with that. Nice. But I'll turn it over to Garrett for the second half. Like I said at the beginning, you know, we've got a lot to talk about. If you're watching, if you comment in the chat, we'll try to, you know, address it as we go. But I will turn it over to Garrett to talk about history and where we about history of the debate and where we go from here.
Oh yeah, so this will be fun. And I don't have controls for it, Chris, so I'll have to ask you to advance the slides. But thanks everyone for following along, and you know, feel free to leave some comments. If there's parts of this presentation that you have questions for, leave them in there, and we'll see if we can address them as we go. If there's just a part of this that you're really interested in and would like to see more, let us know that, and we can, you know, have future live streams that, you know, narrow in and focus on parts of these things, because all of this is a giant topic, like we said before. So Chris gave you kind of a background of a lot of terminology on, you know, what is capitalism, what is socialism at a very high level. But kind of buried within all that is the debates that went on through history of exactly what those terms mean and how we kind of arrived at those definitions, and how some of those definitions are still debated today as capitalism evolves, that today's capitalism is not what it was like 100 years ago or 200 years ago. So let's really briefly go through a history of some of the major debates in socialism and some of the major points in U.S. history with socialism, so we can better have context on how this discussion is going to inform our present work. So the concept of socialism, of kind of cooperation and jointly owning things, you know, as workers and communities, goes, you know, it's always been a part of human history. So let's first make sure that we understand that socialism wasn't just invented like 100 years ago or something like that, right? The concept of it goes all through human history. But in terms of a sociology, a science, a thing that we've studied very carefully to try to understand better as a social phenomena, as an economic phenomena, the philosophy behind it, all this stuff, that dates back only a few hundred years. The roots of it, especially in the West, go to the European Enlightenment era, where there were a lot of advances in philosophy. You know, we started to understand science, physics and chemistry and things, and you started to see the first industrial revolutions as societies transitioned away from the more agrarian societies into kind of what we understand today of cities and industry. And during that time period, you saw a lot of philosophers, you saw who discussed these issues and discussed what it was like to live during that transition, right? So there's way too many philosophers to mention or to talk about for real discussion, but to emphasize a few that were important in especially socialist thinking. You had the philosophers like Immanuel Kant, Hegel, and Feuerbach. And they wrote about things such as epistemology, which is the idea of where does knowledge come from? How do we know what is real knowledge? Like, how do we know what is truth? That sort of, like, it's actually a pretty deep concept, right? It certainly can be. And one of the ways that they tackled how to develop knowledge, how to kind of understand things, is what's known as dialectical thinking, which plays a really key role in a lot of socialist movements. And the idea is that as we're considering a lot of things, there's a lot of apparent contradictions in nature, in human societies. We do contradictory behaviors because we're motivated by different things simultaneously, and we're trying to resolve those conflicts and trying to move forward. So there was a lot of philosophy of dialectics in how do you resolve those conflicts to try to move forward and kind of develop better knowledge and understanding of things. There's also a lot of work in ethics. What does it mean to be a good person? What does it mean to live a good life? And that, of course, plays a big role in socialism, because a lot of it is, right, abolishing poverty. We're trying to figure out what does it mean to live a good ethical life where we're not harming or oppressing others. We're actually helping people. And, of course, that led into philosophy where we looked more at, like, sociology. How do societies interact? How do nations interact? And how can we kind of create societies that can move toward peace with each other, right? And to have this international cooperation that's required to make a global peace, to move beyond the wars and imperialism and all that had existed in history up to that point with, you know, royalty and moving into colonialism and stuff like that, right? How do we move beyond that to have a peaceful, democratic world? Next slide, yeah. So some of the first attempts at kind of answering those questions comes from who were later known as the Utopian Socialists. I don't think they called themselves that. And this was in the late 1700s, early 1800s. Some of the big names of that are, not really good with French, Saint-Simon, who wrote about the working class and identified that workers, as industrialism spread, we're existing in terrible conditions, and so argued that working class people should be better taken care of, and that was necessary to have a more happy, effective society and a more efficient economy. If you exploit workers and put them in terrible conditions, it's not good for anyone. You had Owen, who inherited a business and saw the working conditions of workers, so tried to support workers taking control and taking ownership of that factory. And he argued in favor of better working conditions, shorter work hours, providing things like education to families so that they wouldn't be trapped in poverty, that they would learn stuff. And he even helped try to develop communities around this concept to try to encourage, more worker control of the communities themselves to make sure that workers were always living in better conditions. And then you had, it's Joseph Fourier. I think it's like Charles Fourier is the mathematician. this Fourier is a kind of philosopher, sociologist, who identified poverty as one of the major problems in society. Just like we were saying earlier, socialism identifies poverty. We're trying to abolish poverty as kind of one of our goals. Fourier acknowledged the poverty that was growing underneath the industrial capitalism and stuff, and argued in favor of higher wages and workers' rights. Also was one of the first to talk about feminism and women's rights, as patriarchy and capitalism and all spread, and supported education. So we saw these early utopian socialists talk about these things, but they usually talked about it from the perspective of forming communities that were more centralized, that would kind of oversee and make sure that the workers were taken care of. There wasn't quite as much emphasis on the workers kind of managing everything on their own. It was seen as more of a top-down thing, that like what it means to be a good government or to be a good business owner or whatever is to take care of your workers, as opposed to the workers taking care of it themselves. So while they had a lot of the ideas of socialism in there, it's a little bit different from what developed later. So next slide here. Oops, I think you went too far. Yeah. So that was actually the turning point on why Karl Marx is remembered as such an important figure in socialist history, because he developed an economic analysis that was very detailed and technical and scientific, right? That kind of took those socialist ideas, like, taking care of the working class is great. Yeah, education is great. All this stuff is great. But this idea that you needed a government or a state or a business owner or something to oversee it was part of the problem. So when Karl Marx wrote about his analysis about how capitalism works in works like the Manifesto of the Communist Party, and then eventually his really big work, Capital. One of Marx's key points was breaking with those utopian socialists and saying the state itself is the problem because of all the things we've talked about. It oppresses workers and it's total and all this stuff. And so Marx argued that the state shouldn't be seen as the ideal that we're working for that will create better worker conditions. Instead, the working class has to free itself, that the working class has to create its own institutions and organize and govern itself, essentially, and move away from that sort of concept. And so Marx made the prediction that as capitalism fails and workers organize, eventually that sort of state would wither away, as he put it. And eventually you wouldn't need any sort of centralized state because communities would be able to organize and govern themselves in a society without class, right, where you wouldn't have rich people over poor people. And that state of society is what he called capitalism. I totally ruined that, didn't I? Communism. He called that communism. And so socialist organizing is kind of toward that society as sort of a lawn thing. Next slide.
A quick note.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Today is Engels' 200th birthday. So I just threw a link in the chat for a piece from Left Voice on that. So happy birthday, Friedrich Engels.
Oh yeah.
And then the other thing I wanted to point out, Garrett started off this slide talking about that economic analysis. And when you look at that economic analysis, it's pretty non-controversial. The critiques that Marx laid out are pretty scathing and pretty hard to deny a lot of them. Right? Even today, a lot of them are still very, very, very relevant. So even people who disagree with his prescriptions, right, who disagree with him on the state, who disagree with him with all these things, the criticisms of capitalism, because he took such a scientific approach to his economic analysis, don't have as much room for debate as is left to believe. And so that's something to, keep in mind when you're talking, you're looking at Marx is, the right has had to deal with these things, his ideas, because they're coming to fruition, because they're coming to truth.
Yeah, it's actually very similar to, at the very beginning of this presentation, we mentioned Eleanor Ostrom, who wrote about the commons, and how important points of commons that are successful are that they have to be community run and democratic and open and transparent and things like that. And Ostrom did not identify as a leftist or a socialist. Ostrom just did economic research, sociology research, and came to those conclusions based on observing the real world and looking at how capitalism versus more socialist societies work. In a sense, that was Marx, right? Like doing that economic analysis, you could see the problems with capitalism are at a very core issue. It's not those myths that we talked about. It's not just, well, people are greedy or people are corrupt or whatever. There's a fundamental problem with capitalism that comes out when you do the economic analysis. You don't have to call yourself a socialist. If you just analyze what's going on, you'll eventually reach those conclusions. This is what's playing out in front of us. So that's why Marx is considered such an important point in history, because that analysis is so core to understanding capitalism. And of course, capitalism has evolved since then, so we shouldn't be stuck on just that particular analysis. We have to keep evolving it and critiquing it and developing it, but that was a very important point in history. So because we have to keep developing it, you've seen these different tendencies develop in Marxism over time. And so especially after Marx and Engels had passed away, there was, of course, kind of a grappling over, well, where do we go from here, right? Like, who kind of inherits the movement, so to speak? Who's kind of the person that speaks for socialism? And especially as capitalism was evolving and industrialism was changing, and we started to move toward this more global, national, neoliberal sort of concept of capitalism that we live in today. Different figures came forward with different ideas on how to address it, how to evolve Marxist ideas. And so this is one of those slides that you could have a whole class, right, a whole live stream on. So I'm not going to dwell on it too much. But to emphasize that there were some that decided that capitalism, this more orthodox sort of thing that tried to stay more in line with Marx's original vision, argued that capitalism would eventually fail on its own. And so until then, the working class had to organize in political parties and stuff to try to do the best they could to improve conditions until capitalism failed and we could implement socialism.
They had to prepare for the collapse.
Yeah, prepare for the collapse, essentially, right?
They were the lefty preppers.
Right, exactly. So there are arguments on how to do that, how much you should focus on labor unions versus electoralism, and so you had kind of different wings in there on exactly what that means. But that's where a lot of modern labor parties and all came from. They kind of evolved from that concept of we have to prepare for it, and we can do that by getting involved in politics, involved in electoralism as one method. You also had Leninism arise in Russia, which was like just completely replace what exists today and establish a new worker state under a new political party, like a whole new paradigm. Like don't try to play in the old. And so, you know, the Soviet Union inspired a lot of parties around the world too, to instead of doing a more reformist approach of kind of, we can get some changes here and there. You try to, you know, more systemically change, right, what the, how the system works. And then finally you had, I don't think they called themselves libertarians at the time, but you had another group of Marxists who were very critical of both the electoral labor party sort of strategy, as well as what happened in the Soviet Union after, you know, the fall of the Tsar and creation of the Soviet Union. They were very critical of how authoritarian and top-down the Soviet Union had become, especially under Stalin and all. And so they were critical of those and instead argued that Marxism should take the form of this very anti-authoritarian, bottom-up sort of, you know, very democratic organizing method. So you still kind of see a lot of those arguments in different socialist groups today about like how much should be, you know, union work versus electoral work and, you know, bottom up versus a more top down state approach. So these are all ongoing. So it's good to have kind of a sense that these conversations exist. Related to that is the anarchists, who also originally called themselves socialists. The term anarchist was actually, I think, coined by one of them, Proudhon, who's mentioned here. If he didn't coin it, he at least was one of the first to use it. but their major objection, with the Marxist socialist was that they felt that all of the Marxist approaches were a little bit too centralized, too authoritarian, too top-down. They relied too much on like a small group of people kind of running things instead of trying to organize the working class to and teach working class people to organize themselves, right? To do a very bottom-up sort of organizing. So the anarchists were very critical of all that, and they said, like, you have to be bottom-up, and that means not worrying about the state. That means the state and capitalism, because they've merged, is part of the problem, and we can't rely on state things such as electoralism in order to get the gains we want. We have to organize our communities. So you had a few different types of anarchism that came up too. You had the mutualist under Proudhon, who had a little bit more of a kind of socialist market sort of attitude. It was like an interesting market way of communities through workers' unions and stuff would make trade deals with each other and all, right? And that was how you got around the state and capitalism. Your communities and workers just kind of directly made agreements with each other. You also had the collectivists with Bakunin, who advocated equality. That was a very important thing, political and economic equality for everyone, and collective ownership of the means of production, also emphasizing radical trade unions and workers. And eventually those two ideas kind of evolved into what you would determine today as an anarcho-communist and anarcho-syndicalist. So the anarcho-communists share a lot of kind of the end goals of Marxism, right? That communist sort of thing, but without forming a state, right? Like you kind of bypass that and go straight to kind of your communist, not straight to, but, you know, you organize from the bottom up for it. And your syndicalists take a very working class approach, that you go through trade unions and organizing workers.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand, too, that Bakunin and Proudhon were contemporaries of Marx, right? They debated each other in real life. This split happened immediately. And one of my favorite things, Proudhon actually coined libertarian.
What I was thinking of, yeah.
So if you ever meet a right-wing libertarian in the United States, ask them, so you must like Proudhon. And they'll usually be confused, and then you can tell them that they should read his piece, What is Property? Because he concludes that it's theft. Right. So the founder, the coiner of the term libertarian, which in the United States is a very right-wing, you know, far right-wing extremist meaning, was actually a bottom-left socialist. And it's just been bastardized here, like many other things in the United States.
Co-opted, yeah. So I even put that in there under the mutualist thing. I should have read this instead of riffing on it, but replacing the state with a federation of free communities, that was what Proudhon was advocating, that were organized by workers' councils and cooperatives that interacted and cooperated with each other via market trades. And Proudhon, in his What is Property essay, coined the phrase, property is theft. He was criticizing capitalist private property that owned things for investment purposes. But that property is theft is a really big point in history. And of course, when right-wing folks took the term libertarian, like the Libertarian Party, they of course, property is a very important aspect of their beliefs, so they can't have property as theft, so it morphed into taxes are theft. So that's kind of where that came from.
They dropped they dropped Proudhon's, you know, opposition to hierarchy and just transformed it into opposition to the state.
Right, exactly. So, you had the Marxists, essentially. It's a little bit more complicated than this. There were other factions, groups as well, but roughly speaking, you had Marxists and anarchists who were together at what was known as the First International, the first international meeting of the International Working Men's Association, where representatives from unions and labor movements from around Europe got together to discuss how can we have international cooperation with each other to advocate socialism, how can we support each other if we go on strike, things like that. And at that meeting is where you had kind of a big showdown with more Marxist attitudes versus the more anarchist attitudes. And it was literally Marx and Bakunin were among the people who were literally there arguing with each other. And, Bakunin and the anarchists essentially walked out on the meeting because they couldn't resolve those issues. So you saw a split right there in the two movements. So they are both socialist movements, but they have very strong disagreements on exactly how to organize and carry that out. And so Dan Chodakov has this essay, The Utopian Impulse, that kind of reviews the three kind of major points that they disagreed on. The first one is class analysis. Everyone agrees that class struggle is an important aspect of what's going on with capitalism and our movement towards socialism. Well, there's a disagreement on exactly who we need to be organizing in order to effectively create socialism. So Marx is focused on the industrial proletariat for the most part, workers, whereas anarchists had kind of this bigger view of not just kind of labor, but communities as a whole organizing. So there's a little disagreement on that. The second one is the organizational form. So when we're talking about organizing, what does that mean exactly? What sort of institutions and structures do people build so that they can cooperate and work together? And a lot of more Marxist organizations focus on more of a political party structure that tends to be fairly centralized. Whereas a lot of anarchists kind of reject that more centralized party approach and are much more interested in decentralized movements that are more focused on direct actions and kind of directly organizing workers to do things like strikes. And then finally, the third point is the role of the state, which, as we pointed out before, a lot of Marxists believe that some level of state, you can call it a worker state, is necessary to kind of facilitate a transition away from capitalism. Whereas the anarchist objection was that worker state could actually create, one party authoritarian states, and you'll never actually transition to a socialist society. You'll end up kind of stuck in this authoritarian thing. So the anarchist strongly objected to that as a organizing principle. Those were kind of your major factions in socialist history. One way that I like to kind of summarize all that is Hal Draper's essay, The Two Souls of Socialism, which essentially asks, are we trying to build socialism from the top down or from the bottom up? And I think this is a really great way to think about it, about the different arguments in socialist history and which ones were more successful and not. So Draper argued that all the forms of socialism essentially boil down to either from above or from below. From above is when you appeal to authority rich people or a government or something like that. You appeal to them for funding, you work within it to reform it, or you want something like a worker state. You want to have kind of central control over changes versus this more from a bottom-up point of view, where the working class has to build its own institutions that it runs itself, democratic institutions that can manage their own affairs. They don't have to appeal to anyone else. They do it themselves. And identified 6 points of from above that we should be critical of and watch for. Philanthropism, which is directly asking rich people to pay for it. I think that even goes into like taxing them, right? You tax them and then you make it happen. Well, we've seen how much that's worked, right? in the ways we'll get more into that. elitism is the second one, where you kind of have this idea that there needs to be an elite, a vanguard, a highly educated group that kind of runs socialism. Until the mass people are ready for it, until they've been educated and organized for it. And so, of course, there's some concerns there about, are you creating a new, authoritarian oligarchy sort of situation instead of the working class freeing itself? You have planism, where you focus on social planning, where you just have someone that says, well, if we set up all these rules and we build a community, we do this thing, everything will work great. And that's trying to like create a blueprint for socialism and force it on people instead of allowing people to make their own institutions that make sense for them and their communities. You have communionism, where you're kind of afraid of embracing class struggle. You're kind of afraid of calling out rich people, right? Like you're instead like, well, we just all want to work together for better. And so there's some concerns there with like, I think that really mostly gets to the idea of like the middle class, right? Like middle class people in the US like to think of themselves as being more wealthy. They want to be more like the rich people. For the most part, they're actually the working class. They're actually, they don't own property, they don't own businesses and all. So like you kind of have this thing where you want to be careful about how you talk about class struggle, essentially. There's permeation, where you join the establishment to slowly reform the center of the power from within. That's what we hear a lot from progressive Democrats, essentially, right? Like even the ones that kind of identify as socialist, but then they go work in the Democratic Party, right? Like, if we go in, we can change it from within. And then finally, socialism from the outside, which is saying that we can't really do it internally. We have to wait for someone else to come save us, which could be, an external power of some kind. Wayne Price wrote an essay, Socialism from Above or Below, that was a response to Draper's essay from a more anarchist perspective. Because Draper does reference some old Marxist works that were very critical of anarchism that I think kind of misrepresented some of the anarchist points because of that conflict we were talking about, right, at the First International. There were some misrepresentations from both directions, I think. So what's nice is if you read these two together, you get a really good kind of overview of all the ideas. All right, so... yeah, that part was definitely too long. Yeah, that's okay. We'll have to kind of trim this a little bit. So I don't think I see any special things in the chat. So let's go ahead and talk about socialist history in the U.S. and eco-socialism in terms of the U.S. history, where it came from. So this part shouldn't take a whole lot longer. Let's call it, hopefully another 30 minutes or so. So thanks for hanging in there. now that you've got a background on socialist versus anarchist and that sort of thing, debates in history agreed on the goals, but not necessarily the ways to get there, right? a lot of that influenced U.S. history, as well as you kind of had our own socialist currents popped up on their own within U.S. society. So you saw the formation of many socialist and communist parties in the late 1800s, the early 1900s, as a response to things like the Gilded Age, as workers were more oppressed and in poverty and just not getting help from the government. In fact, they were being oppressed by the government. Some of the earliest police forces, like we were saying earlier, some of the earliest were slave patrols. But then second after that, they were formed to put down union strikes during this era. They were there to protect capital. They were not there to protect workers. So you had a lot of worker movements come up, and socialist and communist parties that came up to try to help organize the workers. One of the most successful, of course, was the Socialist Party itself, that kind of formed from a few smaller parties that had existed before then. And it's kind of the high watermark in U.S. history in terms of how successful it was at electoralism and working with kind of workers' unions and all. At its high point, it had thousands of people elected across the country to all levels of office. Thousands in local office, in state legislatures across the country, and even had a couple of Socialist Party members in Congress. So it was really getting a lot of attention. Eugene Debs was one of the most important figures of it, most visible figures, I suppose, who ran for the presidential ticket several times to draw more attention to it. And Howie Hawkins, in the book The Case for an Independent Left Party, essentially argues that one of the reasons it was so successful is because it, unlike many other parties, committed to a dues-paying membership structure so that the working class could fund itself. It didn't have to rely on wealthy donors and things like that in order to support its own activities, to support strikes and running its own candidates and things like that. And by committing to independent politics with this the membership structure, that was what enabled it to be so successful. So actually, I think this is kind of a duplicate slide, yeah. but partially because it was so successful, of course, there was a capitalist backlash to all this stuff. And we had several red scares in history because of the formation of socialist parties and more radical unions and things like that. So they tried to associate socialist movements with the Soviet Union and scare people and things like that. And they jailed Debs for speaking out against World War I and the draft. Republicans and Democrats essentially teamed up, right? They're like, well, we sometimes fight, but also we're both capitalists, and that's our first priority. So that's what they did. They teamed up to try to suppress independent parties, to make it harder to get on the ballot, harder to run candidates, harder to run get funding. Things like that. A lot of the issues with primaries and debates and ballot access and all were not really laws at that time period. Like, they were put into place during this time period. So a lot of the ballot access laws and all that we face today were created in this time period specifically to try to suppress independent movements because they were so successful, or certainly building towards success, if nothing else. And the other factor, of course, is that while they were suppressing independent parties, they also, it was kind of a carrot and stick approach, right? Stick to suppress independent voters, while at the same time you had a little bit of a carrot thing where if you joined the Democratic Party and supported the Democratic Party, and especially FDR and all, then you got the New Deal, which offered some reforms to capitalism to try to make things a little bit more palatable and better for workers and communities. And, the New Deal, of course, did a lot of good things, and that's why we remember it as you know, kind of a positive thing forward, but also in a sense, as FDR himself said, he saved capitalism, right? It wasn't necessarily meant to meet socialist demands. It was meant to water down socialist demands and try to keep capitalism in power and going. And unfortunately, it worked. The New Deal coalition brought a lot of the labor movements into the Democratic Party, and a lot of the independent parties at the time essentially disbanded. So as a result of that, after World War II and all, after the New Deal, you had a lot of old labor and socialists who advocated joining the Democratic Party because of what they perceived as a success in getting some reforms of the New Deal. And then you had like the civil rights movement and feminism and the beginnings of the environmental movement all start to come up that were able to get some additional concessions, right? That you had civil rights legislation passed. You had the creation of the EPA and stuff that eventually came. So there was kind of this encouragement of, well, socialists and labor parties and all could actually participate within the Democratic Party and get some change. And so you had many folks arguing that, including Michael Harrington, who was a big deal. He ended up co-forming the organization that eventually became DSA today. So it was essentially formed with the purpose of drawing socialists into the Democratic Party. And hopefully that doesn't persist. Hopefully DSA members today will actually advocate for more independence, but that was at least how it formed. And so you had the formation of the New Left, which kind of looked at how the old labor movements were suppressed and said, what can we do differently to organize moving forward to try to be more successful? And so they looked at a whole bunch of other influences. Chris mentioned Horkheimer and Adorno. You had the Frankfurt schools, what they were called. They were they did more kind of social research, right? They analyzed like mass media and things like that, but from a very Marxist sort of lens and perspective. You also had the as environmental movements grew, you had folks starting to ask, how does environmentalism fit in with socialism? And one of the early ones who did that was Bookchin, who created what he called social ecology, which we'll talk more about in a moment here. But all these movements drew from the civil rights and feminism and environmental movements like we were talking about. And as some folks got drawn into the Democratic Party, everyone else started to think about, well, that doesn't seem to be that successful because the Democrats, they'll give us some little, you know, some little carrot, but then they ignore us and they forget us, right? And then they start rolling back those changes, right? Because they're really working for capitalism. They're not trying to create socialism. So you also start to hear murmurs again of like, how do we rebuild an independent movement from that? That can really explain what the problems are. And help organize the working class toward a better future. So this leads us to the eco-socialism and the connection between society and nature. And this quote from Murray Bookchin, I think, kind of helps sum it up. Until society is reclaimed by an undivided humanity that will use its collective wisdom, cultural achievements, technological innovations, scientific knowledge, and its own innate creativity for its own benefit and for that of the natural world, all ecological problems have their roots in social problems. So Bookchin kind of was more among the first to really kind of point out that ecological problems and social problems are really deeply intertwined. A lot of the ecological damage is occurring because of capitalism's growth and endless production and its exploitation, not only humans, but also nature itself. But also, as we address ecological issues, we're not going to really be able to fully address those ecological issues until we address capitalism, until we address those social issues that are underneath it. They have to be kind of this combined effort. We have to see them as two sides of the same coin, essentially, that both humans and nature are oppressed by capitalism. And so in order to free both, in order to live in ecological harmony, we have to actually deal with capitalism. Part of the reason Bookchin was one of the first to be speaking out about this was because prior to that point, most socialists, especially the parties that were organizing at the time, were very laser focused on organizing workers. and addressing worker economic issues and all. And it was the feeling of most at the time that environmental concerns were at least secondary, that they weren't really a major issue that you should worry about. You should worry about the workers first. And some even considered it to be a very like wealthy person issue. Like it wasn't even a thing the working class should worry about. And that was very unfortunate because, you know, we see the connection between these two things now. So connecting it was a very important step toward eco-socialism. So since that time period, since environmentalism started to grow in the 1960s, especially as we saw the effects of industrial pollution, DDT example was, harming birds. And that led to like Rachel Carson writing and creating the EPA, like that kind of created outrage for that. And then also we had the first indications of climate change, where the early scientists were kind of putting it together, saying like the track we're on is not a good one. Like we're going to eventually get to really bad times with climate change. And we're starting to see some of those predictions come true today. So as those early concerns about the environment came up, socialists tried to integrate that into their point of view. And like I said, Bookchin was one of the first with social ecology. He described social ecology as a synthesis of Marxist and anarchist thought. So he was trying to combine the issues, that kind of dialectical thinking we were talking about, right? Like there's some kind of contradictions, there's some disagreements here. How can we kind of put those together and try to get the best of both worlds, right? To try to really create a new movement. And let's base that in ecology while we're at it. Let's make sure that environmental concerns, ecology concerns are, a first class issue, or like a number one issue as part of that movement. It was strongly influenced by a lot of the socialist philosophers that we were talking about earlier. Bookchin essentially used philosophy and science to kind of develop a set of ecological ethics to guide human behavior and to guide our organizing efforts. Lost my place there. So he proposed what he called libertarian municipalism as the praxis, as the way that we should act in order to reach social ecology. And what that municipalism is very bottom-up sort of thing of creating community assemblies and people essentially getting together, making decisions for themselves, kind of like a labor union would, but like instead of in a workplace where you're doing it kind of in a community. So it has a lot in common with other libertarian socialist ideas of kind of bottom-up organizing. Another group that came about, I think a little bit more recently, was kind of this eco-Marxist trend where folks went back to revisit Marx's earlier works and found that Marx actually was talking about the environment in his earlier works. And he talked about the metabolic rift, for example, between industrialism and nature. And you had other groups like the IDWW. We had the quote from them where they mentioned living in harmony with the earth. Yeah, exactly. So actually, even though, unfortunately, a lot of the early 1900s socialist parties and all had kind of sidelined and ignored environmentalism, there is a trend of environmentalism through a lot of Marxist thinking and analysis that did exist there but was unfortunately ignored. And so there's this movement now to kind of reanalyze that and kind of bring it into modern socialist movements. And one of the most recent books was by Saito. I forget what the name of the book is. I think it's Marx and the Anthropocene.
Karl Marx's Eco-Socialism is one of them too, by
Saito. Yeah. But I like this one because he argues for what he calls communist degrowth, that capitalism is obsessed with growth, economic growth, right? And of course, that economic growth means using more and more resources. It's unsustainable, both on humans and on nature. So he's arguing for what's known as degrowth, that instead of our economy relying on growth to create wealth, to end poverty, that we have to create a sustainable system that ends poverty. So we're seeing kind of more discussion and debate over how to do ecology in socialism. Social ecology is particularly important for Greens, as in the Green Party, because it was one of the early influences on the foundation of the Green Party. So we'll take a quick moment here to talk about social ecology. Social ecology draws from studying the past, the present, and hypothesizing about the future to develop an ecological libertarian socialist framework. So we look at the past to try to understand where capitalism and more in general hierarchy, like patriarchy and all forms of oppression, where did that come from historically? And how did past movements deal with that, whether successful or not? What can we learn from those past movements? Then we have to have an analysis of the present. How does capitalism work today? And how do we organize against it in its current form? And then we also have to have a vision of the future. We have to, going way back to the beginning of the presentation, we have to have a vision of what our future society looks like. We can't have a complete blueprint of exactly what it all looks like, because socialism is that process. We deal with things. But we should at least kind of have this overview of what are we trying to accomplish. We're trying to end poverty. We're trying to live in ecological harmony. And we have to be able to communicate what that vision is moving toward for people to understand it and to get along with it. And so that future society that kind of fulfills our goals is envisioned to be based on several key principles. Non-hierarchy, which means that we're basing our society in principles of equality and democracy and just general freedom for everybody. It's based in, and when we say democracy, we don't mean the representative system that exists today. That's really part of the Marxist analysis, that it's really there for the rich, right? We're talking about a genuine democracy that's participatory, that encourages everyone to be involved and help make those decisions. It has to be based in social justice, where we're fighting all forms of dehumanization, whether it's sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, whatever. We have to be opposed to all of that. We have to be for social justice for everyone. We also have to be for ecology, obviously. We have to create our society and economy in a way that's sustainable and in harmony with the rest of nature. And finally, it's built on a moral economy, as Bookchin called it, which is anti-capitalist. It's an economy that's designed to meet the needs of humans in ecological harmony, instead of the capitalist economy that is designed to sell things for profits, right? So that's the basis of social ecology, and where it ties in the Green Party here is that from those movements we were talking about after World War II, we saw ecologically minded socialists get together with, you know, labor movements and things like that to try to talk about creating new independent movements, and not just in the U.S. but globally, in order to deal with environment as well as capitalism, because now capitalism is growing as a global system we have to deal with. And so that started in the 1970s. You saw some early ecological folks running for office. And I think New Zealand, Australia, I think was the first place that started, where they identified as Greens, running on this kind of social and environmental platform. But in particular, the Germans, there was a German Green Party that formed, and they won a bunch of national offices in 1980. And that was really exciting. And that really kicked off forming Green Parties in many countries around the world, including in the U.S. There started to be discussion of how can we do that here in the U.S.? How can we pull together all these old movements away from the Democratic Party into our own independent thing, which I guess is now a Green Party, and kind of get similar success? So that discussion brought together a bunch of different movements and organizations, and Murray Bookchin's organization, the Institute for Social Ecology, even hosted the conference on discussing what a green movement and a Green Party would look like in 1984. Bookchin himself, with Howie Hawkins, who actually studied social ecology with Bookchin back then, argued that this new movement should be based in social ecology ideas. But of course, there were people from many organizations that had different perspectives on this. So it wasn't the only perspective, but it was a really big, important influence. And that led, of course, to the Green Party eventually being founded as this multi-tendency party, you know, a bunch of different organizations, movements coming together with influences from civil rights, feminism, environmentalism, and the peace movements, and influenced, of course, a lot by social ecology. the first formal party, you know, with the paperwork signed and all, was formed in 1991, and it eventually kind of spun off into today's Green Party of the United States in 2000. So that's where that came from. So the Green Party has always kind of had this very eco-socialist, social ecology sort of streak within it through that whole movement, and it was reaffirmed in 2016 where the National Committee, the kind of the big decision-maker body of the Green Party, reaffirmed in 2016, voted and approved a resolution saying that we are an eco-socialist party, and that's where our principles are, and that's what we're organizing for. So the Green Party is, or at least aspires to be, a eco-socialist movement as part, you know, that inherits from a lot of the stuff that we've discussed today. So you can see our Green Party 101 live stream to get more background on that. That goes a lot more into detail about Green Party history, its current structure, its current platform, and all that stuff. So won't get into that here since you could check it out there, but just a couple of key points are that the Green Party, of course, emphasizes political independence as a core organizing principle, not just a tactic. It's not just a thing that, well, maybe in this election we can use it. No, we have to be committed to being independent and having the working class fund itself and all the things we talked about, kind of like the Socialist Party did. And Howie Hawkins makes that argument in his ebook, The Case for an Independent Left Party. It's a very short read. It's literally only like 20 pages or something. So I'd highly recommend that you go and read that. So the Green Party is committed to independence. It's also an anti-imperial movement, inherits from that peace movement, and recognizes that we have to be an international movement, an international green socialist movement, in order for us to be successful, because we're up against green capital. We're up against global capitalism, which I guess is increasingly becoming greenwashed, I think is what I was thinking of. So we have to have this socialist view of how to deal with climate change and all to counter that. And finally, of course, many Greens advocate that the Green Party should be a membership structure with the dues like the Socialist Party did in order to be more successful and to create our independent movement. Currently, the Green Party is not structured that way, but of course, there are folks... you know, the Green Socialist Organized Project who are advocating moving in that direction to be more successful moving forward. All right. So in terms of policy, what do we actually move forward with? And I think the most important thing for eco-socialists to really learn about and talk about and help develop is the eco-socialist Green New Deal. We did a whole Green New Deal 101 on that, so highly encourage you to check out that live stream to get a lot more of the details. So again, won't go into that here, but that's another great 101 live stream. But could you go back there? So I did want to mention that there's a lot more details in there, but the Green Party originated the Green New Deal in about 2010, or a little bit earlier than that technically, but 2010 is when Greens in the U.S. started a campaign on it. So it was originally founded by the Green Party. So even though some folks in the Democratic Party have talked about it, overall the Democratic Party completely rejects it. But even the few that have talked about it, they're talking about this very watered-down version of it that is not the same as what the Green Party first proposed, especially not the same as the form of the Green New Deal that exists today. That comes from the Hawkins-Walker campaign in 2020. That's a revised, expanded Green New Deal that has a full budget that shows how we can get off of fossil fuels and move to a renewable energy economy in a decade or less, depending on how much we fund it, right? And it emphasizes a green reconstruction, the transition to that renewable energy economy, and an economic bill of rights to make sure it's a just transition, to make sure that workers and communities are taken care of during that transition. So where do we go next? Well, we have the Green New Deal that we want to talk about. We want to build organizations like labor unions and political parties, like making the Green Party into a membership party so that we can have more success, we can fund ourselves, we can get political wins toward things like a Green New Deal. And we can... we need to draw from kind of the whole history of the socialist debates and movements that we've seen to try to inform where do we go next and what do we do? What can we take from lessons from history to be more successful as we go forward? Because we're up against some really important challenges with you know, shrinking timelines, right? Like, we have to really act on things like climate change rapidly. So it's important for us to take this moment to study history and to and philosophy and really figure out where we want to go next and what we want to do. So there's some really key questions on, like, how do we balance electoralism versus mutual aid, helping people directly versus unions and organizing our workplaces. Those are still some ongoing debates. And, you know, we can talk more about how we organize that and balance that. How do we organize an independent party and movement while we're under major suppression, right? We have to deal with things like ballot access, especially if you're doing a more electoral approach, right? And how do we balance decentralization and centralization? It goes back to those old socialist and anarchist debates, right? How do we kind of balance these to make sure that we're promoting democracy and this bottom-up socialism at the same time as being able to rapidly, urgently address climate change? So, you know, these are all hard questions. There's not necessarily easy answers to any of these, but it's important for the socialists, the eco-socialist movement to think about them and address them and to talk with each other about how we're going to try to cooperate to make this happen. So that's a discussion for next time. So next time we'll be organizing 101, where we'll jump more into these and other questions. So make sure you mark your calendar. I'm not sure if there's a date set yet, but watch for December. Make sure you like and subscribe and all that stuff so that you get notifications when it when it's announced.
Yeah, our next fourth Tuesday is the day after Christmas. So Garrett and I will have to talk about whether we want to do that or not, if we want to change the date up a little. But yeah, thank you everybody for joining us for our Eco-Socialism 101. Like I said, you know, we started off in 2022 with these 101 series, and we said we were going to, you know, we didn't care about time. We were going to go long, and we had these, you know, 3-hour long workshops. And this year it's been about diversifying and, you know, really narrowing it down. And so clearly we still have a little narrowing down to do on this one, right? We went a little long, but we're working on these workshops. I will say, and I'll give a little hint of what we're going to be working on in 2024. And we're looking to take a lot of these workshops and develop them into workshops in a box, so that Greens that are organizing in their community can download the spread, can download the PowerPoint, can have a note sheet, can, you know, watch our presentations. They can have templates for social media graphics and for flyering, and they can do these workshops in their communities, both as onboarding type stuff and as an educational programming for both the general public and their membership. So we're really trying, you know, we've been developing this 101 series for the last couple of years, and we're really hoping to define it to something that we can turn over to Green organizers turnkey to give them something that they can work on. But thank you again, everybody, for joining us. If you want to, you know, watch past episodes, like if you liked this episode, go look at the 2022 Eco-Socialism 101s we did. We did four of them. The fourth one was literally 2 hours just on people we didn't talk about before, right? Because this is such a large topic that it's really hard to get it, you know, all condensed down properly. And I say that as someone with a degree in political philosophy who taught preschool. Like, that was my job, was distilling things down. And it's just so hard to do with the amount of things that are in this topic. So yeah, if you want to learn more, if you want to see past ones, if you want to get access to the slideshow and things like that, go to greensocialist.net/101s. In the next few days, we will announce when our December one is. And so thank you very much, everybody, and have a good night, and good luck on your local organizing. We'll see you next month.